Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Hogcast, the official podcast of the 442nd Fighter Wing. I'm Bob Jennings, the Superintendent of Public Affairs, and I'm sitting here with Colonel Mike Rio Leonis, the Wing Commander, and Mr. Nathan Hooten, the Chief of Inspections for the Wing, and also Major Select John Lisick, the Executive Officer. We are just coming off of a four-day Super UTA and nearing the end of the 12-day hostage crisis, and at this point, we're all babbling, but more importantly, it's time for Colonel Leonis to babble.
Babble time. Here it is again. And again, $25 more on the table to see if anyone can actually guess why this is called babble time. John, do you have a guess?
Sir, I might guess is that...
Stop. No, you're going to put me down. You're select. You haven't pinned on yet. So yeah, so $25, the total is up to 100. So we did get one guess. Brenda Clark from the command post poised a guess. It was close. No, it wasn't close. It was way off. But she's actually trying. But yeah, $100. And I'll start giving hints as it goes on because we're already up to a C note. So here we are, babble time. All right. Lead well, train hard, ready now is kind of something I've been talking about. Hopefully that has some traction with the members because that's what we did this UTA for sure. So you mentioned promotions, Bob, and we do have a whole bunch of promotions. Major Select, obviously, Lisick sitting here today. And don't forget, he's actually a military side LRS member. He was promoted along with his co-captain, Mike Addis, also in the LRS. Captain Cousins is a Major Select from the FSS. Henderson from the CS is now a Major Select. Kurgowski from the 76th Fighter Squadron down at Moody. Bill Phillips, our new JAG, is a Major Select. Tanner Rindles from the 303rd Fighter Squadron Pistol is now a Major Select. And then Captain Welsh down at the FSS OLA at Moody is also a Major Select. So congratulations everybody there, especially you, John. And, you know, that's a big step. Now you're not a CGO anymore. I'll tell you what, the worst step was leaving that lieutenant dumb and shield because you can be kind of make mistakes and no one seems to care.
You start to lose the excuse. Hey, I'm just a three level.
Absolutely. So,
well, thank you, sir. Yeah, and that's actually great. Yeah, when you lose that ability to be like, well, I just didn't quite get that concept at OTS or school. So it's an interesting way. And thank you, sir, for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had a whole bunch of events outside of our biggest event today, which was. Or the CTA was, which is the exercise. We had a Finney flight for Lieutenant Colonel Rifle Shetterly in the 303rd Fighter Squadron. Absolutely, it kind of hit home to me. You were there, Bob. What was your impression of the entire event there?
It was a really nice retirement ceremony. When you pilots clean up, y'all talk real good.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say it was just kind of real rough, I thought, a retirement ceremony was. But I would say it was so many people came out to say goodbye to Rifle, and that's because he's just a highest quality pilot officer in our unit. Do you know Rifle, John? Do you ever met him?
I know, sir. I haven't had the pleasure. I've seen some of the pictures that were posted on Facebook of the Finney flight, and that was truly a remarkable experience to see how many people came out to support Rifle.
It was also paired with Yeti Smoke, which is named after one of our pilots that passed away 4 years ago, a real good friend of mine, Mike Schriever. So it was paired with the barbecue competition, but it was an absolute full up event, the right way to send off a hero, Rifle Shetterly. I don't know if you heard my speech, but I told a story about when we were deployed in 2014 that I saw him make two of the most difficult tactical decisions I've ever seen a fighter pilot make. One was identifying a weapon through the targeting pod. You're not supposed to do that, but he did. And that identification got that individual targeted and later removed from the battlefield. And then he also employed on not a convoy because they were walking, but it was a march of enemy combatants. It was a Mujahideen, so it wasn't the typical enemy in Afghanistan. They gave signs that they were friendlies, enemy. And he made that difficult decision to accept the identification and enemy and employed on them with another good friend of mine, Fodog. But yeah, best pilot in the squadron is what I said about him. And he's retired and is a kind of a bummer. So anyways, also we had a huge exercise this UTA. John, how did that impact you and the LRS?
So in the LRS, you know, we had support coming from our vehicle maintenance section. as well as our ground transportation. So and within the LRS, those two functions are pretty key as we exercise to move out, especially potentially going to the DCWs.
Yep.
So ground transportation has a lot of the movement, all the movement, essentially capabilities to get us to where we need to go, right? Buses to an airport or transportation to an aircraft or things of that nature, are moving us from one fob to another, you know, and then we have vehicle maintenance, key positions to keep our equipment running. And so exercising their capabilities in a stressful environment is key to making sure that they're ready to go downrange and support the mission.
Yeah.
And they nailed it.
They did.
They nailed it this weekend, as well as CE, you know, the things I heard about CE and the rest of the ACS package that went out there. Just a truly remarkable and supportive equipment opportunity that we were able to provide.
Yeah, absolutely. The scenario was that we were going to set up a FARP for a short amount of time, which is very realistic. And we dispatched, we went from zero notice to equip, process, and deploy about 80 members out to Salina, Kansas. And they set up a camp, basically, and protected it, sustained it for a little bit over 24 hours. There was some weather coming in, so kind of cut it a little bit short.
We weren't sure if we were going to have to send a recovery team to Oz to get you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what you get when going out to Kansas, right? Toto's house.
Yeah. A lieutenant was the OIC, the troop commander there. So Lieutenant Parker from CE was given a huge responsibility to run that camp. And basically it was set up and we were able to turn aircraft out of Salina aircraft. We actually had an emergency, so we weren't able to do that, but we would have been able to do that in less than 24 hours. And just shows our ability to process, move, and deploy our members and set up a combat outpost, basically, to affect the mission. So I thought it was really good. Mr. Hooten will talk a little bit about the design and how he came up with that, but it was a great success. And even though everything didn't go perfectly as planned, we learned a lot, and the lieutenant did a really good job out there. So real proud of him putting a lieutenant in charge, and there's no problem to do that. So any other comments or anything you guys have heard from that stuff?
I'll just say, sir, that just in anything, you mentioned that obviously things always had a little wrench in the wheel on some of the items. Even real world operations, as you can attest, sir, nothing goes as planned and as fragged as usual. Then you have to flex on the fly.
Yep.
And so giving the lieutenant that experience and that opportunity to lead in that, which again, like you mentioned, he exceeded the expectations there and was able to learn from that and take away.
Yep.
And so looking at that opportunity and knowing that you can plan as much as you want. And in logistics, we plan a lot and understand that you're just going to have to be, you know, Air Force Separ Gumby and flex on the fly. And
yeah.
That was a great opportunity.
Absolutely. Because you can't tell everybody what to do. You have to have them make decisions. That's what I want. I want airmen to make decisions. Security Forces, Civil Engineering Squadron, FSS, and the LRS were all involved. Maintenance dispatched an attack team out there, and they were ready to turn the aircraft. We had an emergency, and those aircraft had to return, which kind of, they are actually coming from a flyover that we conducted over the Advent Health 400 at Kansas Speedway out there by the Legends. They were delayed for 3 hours due to rain. And the pilot actually made sure that he basically landed and timed the restart to hit the TOT. And I guess it was a beautiful flyover. So right on there.
My kids were up there with my father-in-law.
No kidding.
Yeah, they were cold. They had a good time, though. We were getting a play-by-play. Someone lost a tire. Oh, there was a crash. This is the carnage I live for. They were having a great time watching cars spin out.
Awesome. And apparently it was the closest finish of any NASCAR race in history. So I thought that was, again, a great recruiting opportunity and kind of flash our wings out there where there's hundreds of thousands of people. I'm not sure how big that.
It's a fairly big arena complex there where they do that, sir.
Yeah.
And so it draws crowds constantly, and those stands are filled all the time. So yeah, like you said, perfect recruiting opportunity for us to get our jets out there and show people the iron that we have and bring them in and get them motivated.
Yep. And Lieutenant Colonel Carl Marks did the flyover there with one of our new pilots, I think Lieutenant or Captain Hart. So great job, guys, on that. The medical squadron, Bob, you said that they did some unique training this UTA.
They did. So they were doing TCCC, used to be self-aid buddy care, level 2 training.
Right.
Which we regular folks get level 1. They get the level 2 so they can fix the stuff that's broken that we can't. And part of that included a field exercise this weekend. They were going to do it in the woods out by the base clinic, but with the weather, they flexed to inside in the deployment center. And they basically set up a scenario. The medical team came in, to an area. There were hostiles in the area. They had to return fire and clear everything out before they could start treating the
damage. No kidding. Kind of no idea that the medical squad, I thought they weren't allowed to carry weapons.
That's what I thought too. I actually called Alexis Waters like, hey, I'm confused.
Yeah.
Aren't you non-combatants? And she told me that now the rules have changed.
Multi-capable airmen.
So if they're taking fire, they're
medic snipers. To return. Gotcha. Okay. It's great to know that. They also had to take a 50-question test, apparently, and everybody passed both the test and the field exercise. So our medical squadron crushed it. I believe almost everybody except for a couple that were dispatched to Salina did that training. So level two, 2 days of training. And that's a lot of resources for the UTA when you basically half the UTA is involved in one event. That's great. So nice to know that our medical squadron can protect us in multiple ways. Operation Spirit, that was another event we had out at the base. It was run by the 509th, and it's basically, I'll summarize it, it is a event for the kids of deployers so that they understand what to expect and what their parents or caretakers are going to go through when they deploy. So, Bobby, you were actually witnessing that. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so what they do is they get the pleasure of going through a processing line, and they get a mission brief. And they did a firing line and an obstacle course, and then all set up in the deployment center parking lot. They had a fuel truck, a fire truck, the EOD truck was out there. They ran about 150 kids through a bunch of different stations. They took them up in the tower. They got to see some jets. And this is actually the first time it has coincided with the UTA. So we're going to press for that to happen
more
often in the future because it was a really great experience for the kids.
Yeah, I'll tell you straight up, I think our wing deploys probably as much as the bomb wing, if not more. So I think that was a perfect, perfect event for our airmen's children and such. So thanks for documenting that as well as PA. And again, keep an eye on it for next year so that we do have it aligned with our UTA.
Will do.
We also had RAT training, Ready Airman Training. Is that what RAT stands for?
That's correct, sir. Ready Airman Training.
Going on everywhere. So I actually watched 4 hours of videos, which was instruction that the maintenance group did last UTA. We filmed it. Bob, I think you filmed it, right?
Well, I provided the camera, and then I was the on-air talent for probably 8 of those 4 hours.
Yeah, we fast-forwarded that one. Absolutely. There was good training all over the place. And I don't know if you did RAT training in the LRS or you guys are ahead because you're actually getting ready to go here later in the year.
Yes, sir. Well, I mean, the LRS is going to always be a hit, sir.
Of course.
I got to give a shout out.
Sure. Go ahead.
But we've been hitting that RAT training really hard.
Good.
The culmination of this weekend, we have just a handful of folks with a few other last bit CBTs to do. But with the upcoming deployment coming up, hitting it hard.
Kind of a new program. You know, everybody is going to be ready come our deployment cycle so that we could deploy more than just the people that are getting tasked because those taskings coming in. So, and that is basically everybody in RCP-05 that's coming up. So great stuff. And again, new program. I think multiple people in the MSG kind of set up and sorted out what that training is and made sure that our whole wing, and then, you know, didn't keep it a secret, but shared it with our wing so that all units can get ready for our deployments, both basically in the upcoming year. So,
yes, sir.
Kind of dance around the dates there.
I talked to a lot of the UDMs. I a lot of communication between the UDMs, communicating to make sure that they were tracking the training for each of the members on that. So they did a really good job sharing information around.
UDMs, unit deployment managers.
Yes,
is that the managers? You have critical position in each squadron. And Craig Burton kind of, well, I would say, maybe oversees them to some extent, even though they work for the squadron commander. So Craig, thanks for making sure everything's going forward. And thanks for every UDM to make sure we're ready now. So awesome stuff. Lives. We dropped some live bombs from a Whiteman Air Force Base. Third time ever that we've done that in our wing. We've been here, since 95? And here's 2024. And we didn't, the first time we pulled a live out of here was less than a year ago. So we started small, but this time we dropped 32 over the course of 2 days up at Fort McCoy in Wisconsin. And I think that went real well. So maintenance had to build the bombs, deliver the bombs, load the bombs, and then obviously launch the jets. And the pilots went up to Fort McCoy and got those bombs off. It's an Army range. So to be honest, it's, well, maybe not as official as Air Force ranges. And I don't know, do you hear the stories in stand-up at all?
So it
had to be, this is no kidding, to drop lives on that range, you had to have a uniformed officer present, and you had to have a terminal air controller to clear the weapon off the airplane. So what we have is forward air controllers, which are a single aircraft mission where it's a special qualification in the A-10, and they're terminal air control qualified, similar to a JTAC, and they are also a uniformed officer. So the uniformed officer was the terminal air controller who was flying an airplane among the others dropping lives. So kind of a, you know, I don't want to say we tricked the Army, but we were able to hit their requirements in a unique way. And props to the ops group.
That's called efficiency.
It's called efficiency. There you go.
That's why we're in the Air Force.
Props to the ops group in solving that puzzle without having to deploy someone up there. And quite honestly, that's their job. The forward air controller's job is to control fires. And thanks for maintenance for building bombs and delivering bombs and loading bombs. Also, 509 supported us.
Speaking of the 509 supporting us, another unique first that happened, I'm told, with this live drop exercise was it's the first time we have launched a loaded jet out of a B-2 hangar.
That is absolutely true. I think there was one of the load sites that was too close to one of the assets here on the base, so they wouldn't allow us to load weapons. But they gave us a hangar, a B-2 hangar, and we loaded weapons in a B-2 hangar, which is a sited, you know, they obviously have bombs, and they've dropped live bombs out of here. So we loaded in a B-2 hangar. That's a great point out, Bob. I hope we have a picture of that.
We do.
Great man, Bob. PA King right over there.
I mean, you know, I do what I do.
No, but that's good. And I mentioned a couple UTAs ago that we're storing bombs in the 442nd bomb igloos for the first time ever. So that's awesome stuff. We're getting rid of them. So this is something that we didn't talk about beforehand, and we got to just kind of keep it very gray. But Commander of Subgroup 9 posted on Instagram a picture of an A-10 next to a submarine. And that happened this weekend up at the Pacific Northwest. And we supported the Commander of Subgroup 9 and the initiative of the 422, which is the test squadron at Nellis Air Force Base. And we were requested by them to help support this mission, which we can't really talk about. But the Instagram post is awesome. Bob, trying to figure out how to share it on our stuff.
It'll be up on our Facebook.
Okay, we'll put it on Facebook. But it's an incredible shot. You know, it's Pacific Northwest, so it's not sunny. There's water, and we'll call them hilly shoreline. And there's an A-10 right by a submarine. And it's just an incredible picture. And we did that this weekend. Again, there's the missions classified and stuff like that, so we're not going to talk about it. But take a look at that and just see that we are working for not just Army JTAC units or stuff like that. So great stuff. And get that out. Have you, saw the picture?
I have not seen that picture.
Show them the picture.
I've been waiting for Bob to send it to me here. On that, sir, have we supported this mission before?
Absolutely not. This is all, we'll call it emerging requirements. And we were asked to be the initial cadre with the 422 out of Nellis. And quite honestly, the guy that reached out to us was a former pilot in our squadron as part of the Total Force Integration. He was a Lobo in our squadron. And he is now flying at the 422, and he reached out to us and asked us if we wanted to support, and we absolutely did. Quite honestly, it was a completely untimely time to support this. We got an exercise going on. We've got a NASCAR flyby. We've got the lives going on, but we still made it happen in maintenance. Wow. The puzzle they solved this UTA when it comes to aircraft. I appreciate that a lot. You know what else I appreciate? How many tornadoes have we had in the last 2 weeks here?
Quite a few, sir.
Two tornado warnings at Whiteman Air Force Base. And as you know, now as a wing commander, if the airplanes get taken away in a tornado, I'm probably fired. But both times, our maintenance and an ops team made sure that they were hangared. And we're not talking under the sunshades. We're talking in the hangars. So they, again, coordinated with the bomb wing for some of the hangar space, loaded our hangars up, and made sure that both times that we had tornado warnings, that our aircraft were protected. So when I was on the road coming towards the storm, and that's when the tornado warning went off. And the other one, I was in bed at 12:30 at night when it went off. And both times I felt very comfortable that I knew our airplanes were safe. So thanks to maintenance and ops for making those decisions, but quite honestly, maintenance for towing those aircraft and shelter them. Because like I told them, I don't know if you heard, Mike, you were actually in Hawaii, John. So you didn't get to hear it. It's like, You could have made the decision not to do it based on the weather forecast or to do it. And they took the hard decision, the one that required more work, to one that required more time, and the one that affected the flying schedule the next day. They made that decision rather than the easy decision. And it was the right decision. So props to them. All right. I'm going to start talking about our future real quick, and then we'll talk to Mr. Hooten. Future. So that one April report that was supposed to outline the future of all the fighter aircraft within the Air Force, all units that are converting, divesting, remissioning, closing, etc., was supposed to be submitted 1 April to Congress. It's not there yet. So it's still within the Pentagon. And so the answer that that document is going to give us, hopefully good, is not out yet. So, you know, just realize that Congressman Mark Alford is coming to visit the base on 30 May, and I'm going to definitely have at least an hour with him and make sure that I give him an update on what's going on with our future and stuff like that. So be assured that I'm going to make good contact with him. And then the commander of Air Force Reserve Command is actually talking to the commander of ACC, Air Combat Command, this week. And one of the topics is obviously going to be our future. So in summary, everybody knows our issues. Everybody's concerned and everybody's working forward to try to solve that. We're kind of in a lull right now, because the budget was just signed and now they're actually working on the 2025 budget. And there's some testimony out there in Congress to the Appropriations Committee, who basically cut the checks for next year. And there's one that has the reserve component commanders, the commander of the Air Guard, the commander of the National Guard, Navy Reserves, Army Reserves, and General Healy, the commander of Air Force Reserve Command, testifying to Congress. So it's on YouTube, worth taking a look at. Nothing specific about us, but certainly specific about the fighter force. But they're talking about everything else, boats, tanks, space. So it's not 100% relevant, but it's definitely worth a look, especially if you have a long drive or listen. So anyways, guys, that's babble time. I think we went long, but I think it's good stuff. I think we hit the good stuff about our wing. Bob, do you have any final comments before we wrap it up? Talk to Mr. Hooten.
It was a really great UTA.
It was.
I think we got a lot of training done, a lot of readiness boxes checked. Another thing, medical, in addition to doing their TCCC training, they came up with a way to help get some of our mental health assessments taken care of efficiently and in-house without having to go through an outside.
Good point out. Yeah. So the mental health contractor that does our mental health evaluations wasn't funded for probably about a month. So we came up with an idea. John, you were gone, but we came up with an idea to actually execute those with our in-house providers in the medical squadron. And they, instead of doing 30 over a course of the month, they ended up doing 93. So that's a triple the output of a month and just 2 days. And what's funny is I was at the ROA, the Reserve Organization America conference, and there's going to be an interaction with a congressman from Alabama, from one of the, we'll call it the national leaders of that organization. And they were going to talk about the dental program and the mental health program. And I said, I've got a lot of data for you, and now I'm going to update them. So, you know, because both of those programs are kind of challenging. We don't have control over them. And if you look at our readiness, dental, mental health evaluations are big hits on both of those. And I don't think everybody's teeth are bad. You know, I just don't think they have the documentation to say that they're good. And then obviously, I hope people don't all have mental health issues. But if they do, they need to get that evaluation so that we can get them some help. So yeah, good point out, Bob.
And a shout out to medical on that, because I did do that process just before I went TDY, sir. So because I was red on that one and because I was struggled to get into the online provider. And within 10 minutes,
perfect,
I was good to go for medical.
Yeah.
It was a phenomenal process.
So yeah, great initiative by Alexis Waters. And, you know, Colonel Greenspan, the commander there, has done a lot of chipping away at making that organization more efficient. And their full-time staff is phenomenal. Definitely appreciate what they do over there. All right. Final comments.
Don't forget your mothers on Mother's Day and make wealth. Throw that out there for everybody just to make sure to get those flowers and cards to your moms.
Good point. We'll probably be posting this after Mother's Day, so it'll be too late, John. Thanks. But for everybody except for me and Bob. So, but that's good. All right, guys, let's interview Mr. Hooten. Thank you. Hard Bob. Today we're going to talk to Mr. Hooten with an O. I've been corrected there. Did you see my last email where I threw some extra E's in there? That was a joke, as you could tell. Mr. Hooten comes to us from the Bomb Wing. We were actually able to hire him away from their IG team. But if anyone has been in the wing more than a few years, you realize that Mr. Hooten was an ART for a very long time in the Civil Engineering Squadron and was actually a chief master sergeant in our unit before he left and went to another unit, which we're going to talk about a little bit. So, Mr. Hooten, why don't you give us your background, how you got into our unit, where you grew up, and how you got vectored into the 442nd.
All right. Well, thank you for the introduction. I was basically recruited into the 442nd. At the time in 1999, I was working for the Missouri Department of Conservation as a land surveyor. And my adopted uncle, Chief Isaacson, who was a command chief here in the wing for several years and retired in December of 2007, he was in CE at the time. And he kind of turned me on to this opportunity. At the time, I wanted to be a professional land surveyor. And he said, hey, you know, there's a job in the Air Force that is exactly what you're doing with the conservation department. And we can help you get education paid for, help you get training, and just really explained what the reserve was all about. And I, at the time, was a young guy, well, not young at the time, but 22 years old, and thought, man, what a cool opportunity. And at the time, I was working towards becoming a professional land surveyor. And so I talked to the Missouri Land Surveyors Association. They said, hey, we'll give you half the credit you need to be a professional surveyor once you go to tech school and you get this training. So I'm like, okay, bet. And that was just the training I was getting from basic training.
That's kind of an incredible insight for the government, the Missouri state government, to realize that you're going to get some training to actually give you an absolute boost to join. That's kind of, I'm kind of surprised that a government actually was going to give you credit without an official program. So that's awesome. So that was kind of the final step that said, hey, I'm going to do this to accelerate your civilian career.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a land surveyor. Interesting. But talk to me about your mentor again. He was in the 442nd in the Civil Engineering Squadron, and you said he retired in 2007?
Yeah, Chief Isaacson, he's an interesting guy. He's best friends with my mom and dad prior to rejoining the military. He joined the Air Force in 1969, and wow. Was in Vietnam as an aircraft mechanic in Vietnam. And he hadn't met my parents yet. It was only until after they got out of the military. And he had a 25-year break in service.
No kidding.
And joined the reserve. He joined the 442nd Civil Engineer Squadron at 40 years old.
That is awesome.
Or, yeah, right at 40.
40 years old.
Mm-hmm. And then so he did another 20 years, and he joined the 442nd CE Squadron as a staff sergeant.
Okay.
And then became command chief of this wing.
Wow, that's awesome.
And so he really kind of showed me the way, as it were.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of people that have a lot of great things for those folks that were a part of the wing at the time. You know, we affectionately called Chief Ike the cerebral assassin. And he was just the best listener that I ever knew. And I really, along with a lot of other people that I had the pleasure to work with him, try to mirror the way we behaved and the way we led people based on his example. So,
gotcha.
Yeah. And I joined in 1999. In February of 99 is when I joined the Air Force Reserve and the 442nd Fire Wing.
And just I went right to basic training.
Yep.
Right there. And yep. I went right into the Civil Engineering Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me your path there. I mean, you obviously came in as a TR.
Mm-hmm.
How quickly, once you came, how long were you a TR?
So I was a TR from 99 until 2008.
Wow.
Yeah. As fate would have it, I was working in... It's really kind of interesting how life's kind of come full circle. So I was working as a quality engineer in automotive manufacturing.
In Kansas City?
Well, in central Missouri.
Okay.
But I represented companies like Ford, GM, okay. and Chrysler, and tier one suppliers to provide widgets to this industry. And so,
gotcha. Vendors.
Yep. And so I was a vendor rep.
Okay. Vendor rep.
But when the economy of 2008 started to tank, the writing was on the wall. I actually worked for my father at the time. He had a company called Hooten Management Systems, of all things, creative name. But we were doing this work. And when the economy started to tank, our number one client was like, hey, you know, it's not looking good for a follow-on contract. And so you guys may need to think about doing something. So
wow.
My dad was like, Nate, you know, we got to figure something out. And I'm like, we joke about it to this day, but I said, I can't believe you fired your own son. So
it's all about business.
Right? Yeah. It just so happened that an art position came up in the unit and in CE. And I got orders to Iraq. So we were going to deploy to Kirkuk. And I came on orders before the deployment and kind of took a look at things, was helping out with the UDM.
Right.
Getting people ready to go out.
Learning some of the full-time tasks that you were probably not familiar with as a TR.
Yep. Working with Jeff Craney.
Okay.
For those that remember him.
I do.
He was an art then, and so was Rick Schrober. So Lieutenant Colonel Joe Harold is like, hey, why don't you come out on orders and see if this is something you'd like? I actually applied for the job, interviewed while I was in Iraq with Colonel Chuck French.
Yep.
You remember Colonel French?
I do remember him, yeah.
And he hired me while I was overseas.
No kidding. So I did not realize that you had such a long time as a TR.
Yeah.
So definitely knew what you're getting into, mm-hmm. more or less. That was back when the art jobs were hard to get.
Mm-hmm.
So awesome. So obviously you made an impact as a TR for the first 8 or 9 years and got in the art job. That's when I met you, because we went right into ORE time. We'll call it the dark times, which are coming back, by the way. But you know, that was my first exposure to anything not ops or maintenance. And in reality, you know, my maintenance exposure was limited because as a young major, I might have been a lieutenant colonel, but as a pilot, I really didn't interact with the leadership or the enormous support function that comes up with getting the jets ready. So it was really impressive to me to meet very competent and high-level leaders outside of the ops group, to be honest with you. So that's where I met you, as part of the EET team.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we had positive and learning discussions as we go. You probably did not like me.
No, I initially. Did. As a matter of fact, I, you know, for those of you listening out there, I don't know how well you know this commander, but, you know, he was charged with an enormous task that none of us really knew what to do, nor did we really want to be there. But we spent countless hours, and I was a young guy trying to make my way in the wing, trying to represent the CE group. But one of the conversations we had, and I don't know if you remember this or not, you said to me, and so part of my job at the time as an engineer assistant was actually doing aircraft damage assessment, and really was time sensitive. And so in the scheme of the ORI, we only had so much time to get this thing done. And at the time, Colonel Clemens, Rock Clemens, he just wasn't happy with the time. And you said to me in a meeting, you said, Hootie, I'm not an expert at ADAT, but I need you to get it done in like 10 minutes. I'm like, sir, it's just physically not possible to drive a Humvee, an up-armored Humvee in Mach 4. Down a 10,000-foot runway looking and calling out damage. I said, it's just not possible. And you said, I don't care. It's what the wing commander wants. And I thought, this guy. Yeah, so it was great.
Yeah.
But that's a fun memory.
Those are some tough memories. I remember the CE compound, and I just learned a whole bunch about so many different functions. And it's like, yes, you know, when you think about flying, it's like, hey, we just fly. We have a whole bunch of different missions. And every unit in our wing has the FSS, the CE, the LRS, security forces, they have more than one mission within the squadron, multiple AFSC. So I got to see the diversity of the whole wing. So it was good for me. So you obviously remained as an ART, and the ORI days went away. One thing that I also noted, and you were able to educate me on this, is it's not just the aviation package that deploys. And quite honestly, when we deploy, we deploy to the biggest FOB in the country. And, you know, if we get close to the wire, it's a bad day, other than we fly. And obviously there's risk associated with that. But you have deployed multiple times when you've been outside the wire significantly. So why don't you give me kind of the summary of those deployments and what the 442nd CE squadron did downrange, supporting mostly Afghanistan, but obviously CENTCOM.
Yeah, we, in the early days, as a matter of fact, my very first deployment in 2000 was, there was 13 442nd civil engineer airmen that were the first Air Force civil engineers to do 90 days in an AEF. And that was in 2000. And that was before 9/11. So Operation Southern Watch. And so it was kind of the first of its kind. And that was led by guys like Chief Ike and Chief McDonough.
Yeah, that's like
Mike
Ozak.
Yeah.
Well beyond the annual tour requirement. Absolutely. Back in the day.
And as a matter of fact, back then, there were airmen, guard and reservists that were doing, you could do 2 weeks, 30 days, 45 days, 60 days or 90 days. You could select your own adventure.
Yeah. Dial a duration.
Yeah. And so that was the first go. And then we went to Iraq 2 different years back to back, went to Afghanistan in 2011. And that's really where we, there was a time then the 577th Expeditionary Prime Beef Squadron was one of 3 squadrons in a group that the really was only the, since World War II, had we been doing things that the Air Force engineers were doing as the Allies were advancing in Europe. You know, they were sending engineers forward. You know, that's what really Red Horse was born from.
Okay.
And so they were sending these engineers forward in Europe and basically building airfields out of nothing just to help support the troops advancing. And so that hub and spoke concept really began there.
I guess it is spoking forward rather than 360. You're spoking forward to support the movement of the FIBA.
And what we learned, I guess what military leaders learned at the time during Enduring Freedom was that Army engineers were okay, but they weren't as good as Air Force engineers. Army engineers are, they're engineers, but they're infantrymen first.
Trap.
Air Force engineers are engineers always. Yeah. Right. And so what we were doing in Afghanistan in this little period of time, just about a 2-year period of time, is all this little hub and spoke concept was alive in country. It's since moved to Al-Udeid. But we were supporting the Army with engineers to do all kinds of light troop labor projects. So we were building bee huts for people. Guys, Army guys were taking showers with water bottles. Our own airmen were taking water bottle showers in these austere places because they didn't have running water, or the facilities that they had were inadequate, or all kinds of stuff. We could go on and on about that. But that's what we were doing in 2011 and 12. And then since then, yeah, I mean, I've deployed since then, but most recently, the last CE deployment, there was some of those same people in 2011 doing it again out of Al-Udeid.
Okay.
So they moved it out of Afghanistan in 2012 and moved it to Al-Udeid.
And then you're actually, instead of having your home base in Afghanistan, your home base was the deed, and you'd go into Afghanistan.
I didn't personally.
But that was it.
But that's what
concept.
The current members of the CE squadron were doing back
then. I know that country changed significantly from 2008 to 2012. That's the difference in the infrastructure that we as a country built up in there was phenomenal. And you were obviously involved in that. Where exactly in Afghanistan was the 442nd, or was it spread out all over the place?
Well, we were hubbed out of Bagram.
Okay.
And a little compound behind the barbecue defect for anybody that was there. So just
familiar.
South Disney. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where we were at, really nestled between the barbecue defect and bulk fuel storage.
Okay.
Which was like super sketch.
Yeah.
I mean,
open flame.
Oh, yeah.
At a fuel depot.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really crazy. But so we covered all RCP north.
Okay. East, you know. So you went RCP north.
And west and south.
Okay. So, yep. All three of them. And you're hubbed out of Bagram, but you had to go out in the field. How long were your movements out in the field when you left Bagram?
Some guys were there and out the entire.
The whole time. Outside the wire. Months. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fully armed the whole time?
Fully armed, fully loaded, combat loads, M4, 7 mags of 30 rounds, 4 magazines of 9 mil, just loaded to the hilt.
Yeah.
And you pack a 72-hour bag that really turns into 6 weeks.
Your RV.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. Yeah, and that's something that I think we could probably talk forever about, just those experiences. And I know, obviously, the aviation package is combat tested. Security forces have had some serious duties guarding bases that took fire all the time. But I think some of your stories are extremely diverse. And who escorts you when you go out on these? Are these part of PRTs, or are they kind of even before that?
Well, it was kind of after PRTs.
After PRTs.
Yeah. So depending on the mission, it was, I mean, it really was the Wild West. You could go to the air terminal and catch a helicopter to Kandahar and nobody know you left. It was just kind of weird. But a lot of the outside the wire stuff was coordinated. Basically, we were working for the Army.
Okay.
And so the mayors at these different FOBs, the Army, they had a captain that was typically in charge of that FOB, and they would coordinate security efforts. So guys would go out in convoys, guys would go out in dismounted foot patrols and with the protection of the Army. But it's not like we had Air Force uniforms that made us. I mean,
right. So absolutely. Yeah. You were one of the Army teams that went out. And give me an example of a project that either you worked on or someone else in our unit worked on that was significant and maybe a more serious threat location.
Well, there's a handful of guys still in the 442nd CE now that probably have a lot more graphic detail to share. My role at that time, I ran the operations flight.
Okay.
I was in charge with movements and intel. So I provided intel to all the command for where all of our troops in country were located. But one of the experiences I had was we went to a place called Fob Mustang, which is right on the Pakistan border, basically Tora Bora region where heavy Taliban presence. And there was just this listening post where we had 13 guys. And then there's some other guys that are probably going to listen to this that know this place and actually went there and worked. But
it's called Fob Mustang?
Yeah. OP Mustang.
OP Mustang.
Post Mustang. And these 13 guys lived there. And they would take rotation. They were in country for a year. They take 6 month rotations on the mountain and then off.
Mountain.
Yeah. And it was literally on the spine of a mountain overlooking a base in the valley. We're providing early warning detections. And so all of their stuff was powered by generators. All of their power, all of their observation and listening equipment, it was powered by generators. And of course, they had to have fuel for these generators sling loaded by helicopter up to this LZ or to their little LZ. Well, when the generators would die because they were out of fuel, the Taliban would attack them.
So when the generators
would
interesting.
So the generator noise would subside and it'd be quiet. And then that's when the enemy knew that they didn't have capability to use their audio or visual equipment. And so that they would attack. Huh. Yeah. So really crazy. So what,
Enemies are not stupid sometimes.
No, they're not. So what we do, we'd go take a look at these projects and then provide the army, hey, we can do this. It's going to take this, this, and this equipment. Our engineer teams would build bills of material. One of the other things that we were doing, they didn't have any hot water. So they're filling water bladders with 1 liter bottles of water. And then they would just stand underneath this thing and take air temperature water, whether it was hot or cold. So we ended up putting in a water heater for them. They had their sleeping quarters built on some crappy stilts. So they had sleeping quarters on top of their sleeping quarters. They had sandbags that were surrounded by HESCOs and a weight room. I mean, so the place, it was just hastily,
sounds army to me.
Yeah, hastily built. And so what we do is send our engineers in there to make things better. And that's just one of many. Many projects.
So for people that are familiar with the Asgards and the Konar, which is this river valley that comes out of Jabad, and there's Abad up there. I can't remember all the fobs. I think Fob Monty's up there. These are all in the river basin. But yeah, they talk about a critical listening post for the war. That's a hot valley. I've spent a lot of time above the Konar to know that that's not a good place to be. So
yeah,
6,500 feet in elevation. So up the hill for sure. Yeah. I'll try to plot that on that, but everybody's familiar with the Konar. I'd say as a unit, an aviation unit, our wing has flown more over the Konar than any other, we'll call it recognized location in Afghanistan. So I wish we were there at the same time. You know, that's kind of the bummer about our deployments. They weren't synced up. It would have been great today. Hey, how's it going? Actually have someone that we know from Missouri, from the 442nd underneath our watch. That's kind of where we're going with deployed combat wings. So maybe some people are thinking straight, but that would have been a great synergy for sure. So awesome. Obviously a well-deployed unit, like we talked about, and you obviously well-deployed as well. Talk to me about we'll call it the senior leadership part of your career at the 442nd.
Well, so I went to Afghanistan, IUD'd for another deployment in 17. I did 6 months as an IRT project manager away from the office for AFRC. That's basically an OSD reserve engineer training thing.
Okay.
Building houses out in New Mexico.
Oh, no kidding.
For the Navajo Housing Authority. So okay. I led that effort on behalf of AFRC. So I went from 2008 to 2017, kind of ready for a change.
Yeah.
Been in that organization and I'd kind of tapped out in my role in that organization. So an opportunity came up in the IG.
I'm going to slow you down here because you kind of just talked about a project, kind of glossed over it. Mm-hmm. Talk about working on the Navajo reservation as part of AFRC. Mm-hmm. I don't know if everyone knows what Mr. Hooten is. Native American. What tribe?
I'm a member of the Cowlitz Indian tribe. We're located basically in the shadows of Mount St. Helens as our Aboriginal territory, just north of Portland, Oregon, north of Vancouver, Washington. So that I-5 corridor that basically runs from Portland to Seattle is Cowlitz country.
Gotcha. And yeah. I know it's very important to you.
Yes, sir.
You're on their council.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you mentioned that you were able to find a project that aligned with your heritage and something you really cared about in Africa, tell me how you got that project and that job.
So, yeah, it's an Office of Secretary of Defense program, and there's different levels of programs, and there's POCs from each branch of service that work in DC. And so they get together annually and say, hey, these are the projects. So this IRT program, not-for-profit organizations get together and petition the government and say, we've got this money and these resources. Can you provide labor? And what happens is we send engineers all through the Joint Force, Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine engineers to these places and train, do construction. And there's projects all over the United States, and they vary in complexity. I know that there's been one where they redid a national jamboree for the Boy Scouts of America. The 442nd has sent people to Gallup, New Mexico, yep, for the project I was mentioning. We've sent to YMCA the Rockies to do, okay, refurbishment on those kind of things. So what it really does is, outside of those are your annual tour, your
DFTs basically.
Yep, DFTs, exactly.
DFTs, not to Italy or Charleston.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so they're really more based solely on the skill set of kind of awesome construction.
And talk about giving back.
Yeah. So for that particular event, they did a data call for people who are interested in, I know Chief Bryant, the SEL and CE now, he went on one, and we had a couple leaders since then participate as well. But you petition AFRC and say, hey, I'm interested in being a project manager. And so you apply and they select you. And it just so happened that I got that particular job, where I spent the spring and summer,
yeah,
leading Navy and Air Force engineers and building these houses. And this wasn't just building the houses. We'd go do sewer connections.
Wow.
We'd take the houses out, place them, meet with the families that we were delivering these houses. And I just, of course, with my culture and the people involved in the Navajo community, I had a wonderful time, yeah, and really was, I felt like a true ambassador to the reserve, just simply.
Yeah, what an awesome, yeah, what yeah an alignment with who you are.
Yes, sir.
And was that a random assignment, or did you like list it as like, hey, I want these three first? Is it just completely random?
Well, there was three. There was that job, YMCA of the Rockies, and another one. And the reserve said, these are the projects that we will support.
We're going to support.
So it was one of those three. And so that just,
yeah, we'll talk about not luck, but just what a perfect synergy with who you are. That's right. Awesome. And then you were up for that cycle to do that. So what a great, that mm-hmm must have been very rewarding and such. All right. So sorry, I off-tracked you there. Bottom line, you and your senior part of your career with the 442nd, finish up what you were talking about there.
Yeah. So a newly assigned position in the wing was available, and that was the superintendent of the IG shop. And so that had not been filled before. There were some efforts, whether it was orders or just random positions, where people kind of did some of the work of the early Air Force inspection system.
Right.
We started doing in-house inspections and exercises, but it wasn't really fully developed yet. And so I was selected by Colonel Leckfeld, former Vice Wing Commander, who was the IG at the time. And I was the first reserve IG superintendent here at the wing, and did that for a couple of years until another opportunity.
Still a TR and civil engineer.
Well, I was an ART.
An ART.
That was an ART.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it was really an even swap, but I was ready to do something else. So it was a lateral move. And what it was designed to do is just to set that up. I was green belt certified, black belt trained. Inspections and auditing is what I did for
absolutely
a living. And so prior to becoming an ART. So it's kind of in my blood and in my DNA.
That's a perfect alignment, yes, with you.
Yeah. So looking for a challenge, but something that was still valuable to the wing.
Yeah. Awesome. So you did that position for about 3 years, if I recall.
About
3 years.
Yep.
And then you had an opportunity to, you were chief at that point, correct? Chief Master Sergeant at that point?
No, I was selected for the SEL job down at Fort Worth.
Fort Worth. Yeah. Okay. And that's where you pinned on.
Yes.
Okay. So you went down to you left our unit, which probably difficult for you. And we kind of talked about what we think about this unit, both of us. So leaving this unit must not have been an easy thing for you to do.
No, it wasn't. I went from TR. I'd spent over half of my career at that point as an ART.
Yeah.
And this is the only military unit at the time that I'd known. So yeah, it was, but all of the opportunities that I tried to seek out at that point in time, you know, and there was, you know, promotion opportunities that didn't go my way. And so I was looking for an opportunity to not only perfect some of my skills, but advance too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so there was a need down there in the S team.
Yeah, what was the actual organization?
The 822nd
S team.
Flight. Yep.
And it's what's the S team stand for? What's the S?
Staff Augmentation.
Staff Civil Engineering. So kind of an interesting, I saw a lot of those members at your retirement, mm-hmm. and they all were highly ranked. There's a lot of colonels and a few colonels, lieutenant colonels, and chiefs. It seemed like they were ready to augment civil engineering staffs or MAGCOM staffs in case of war. So pretty interesting. Didn't know that unit even exists. And you were actually discouraged to go down to that unit, apparently, because it was stale, perhaps.
Yes.
And under a lot of vacancies, mm-hmm. you said, and just kind of stale. And you went down there and you met your new commander. Mm-hmm. What was his name?
His name is Christopher Blanchett.
Yep. Gotcha. I assume you still stay in touch with him.
We do. We talk about bourbon and baseball and things of that nature.
Good.
They're listening. What's up, Colonel?
Good. We'll maybe shoot it to him direct.
Yeah.
But you went down there and you, instead of accepting the staleness of the unit, you made a change.
Yeah. Historically, S-teams have been underutilized. And that particular S-team had kind of been bounced around a little bit. There have been a lot of changes in 10th Air Force. As a matter of fact, the 822nd S-team was sitting in 10th Air Force headquarters.
Okay.
And they wanted the extra space. So they kind of moved the S-team out and kind of forgot about them. Yeah. Even though, surprisingly, the S-team at one time fell underneath 10th Air Force. Then the reorg happened, and then they fell under 22nd Air Force.
Okay.
So you've got a 22nd Air Force GSU sitting in the shadows of 10th Air Force headquarters and the 301st Fighter Wing, but completely separate.
On a Navy Reserve base.
Yeah, so really interesting dynamic there. And so it was very kind of, some people went down there and just kind of hung out. They were underutilized. They had a pretty good time. And to your point, somebody said, oh, you don't want to go down there. It's a retirement community.
Yeah.
But that's never been what I've been about.
Absolutely.
And so when I got down there, our full-time AGR was deployed. So we had a on-loan tech sergeant admin person.
Okay.
Who didn't know how to do readiness reporting, didn't know anything about UTCs. And so what I was able to do was parlay all my ART experience as a TR and really kind of limp us along and kind of help. Colonel Blanchett had a vision and I shared that vision, and he's readiness minded. I'm a readiness geek too.
Yep, so absolutely.
It really just kind of was a good,
perfect
good marriage.
Rejoin down there.
Yep.
You talked about there were 20 people when you showed up there, many vacancies. You actually recruited heavily. And who did you recruit?
Yeah, it was good. It just was kind of perfect timing. I recruited two of my former commanders, another one of your commanders who was seeking opportunity, and then another engineer who was ready to separate. She's a joint spouse and her husband was active duty and got out, and she was ready to do the same and kind of convinced her to stick around. And so when we went from a 20 to in 2 years, we went from 21, I believe, to 32, almost a completely full S team.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And you said when you showed up there that the training was a mess.
It was a mess. As a matter of fact, we were the fourth worst trained unit, statistically speaking. Now, you take a unit like yours, the 442nd, you've got, 130 people.
I think we'll call it a unit like ours.
Okay. Yeah. A unit like ours here, where it's 130, 140 people, and then you go to a unit of 36. It is the requirements. There's more, but statistics are statistics.
Yes, absolutely.
So statistically, we were fourth. And at one time before I left, we were able to be tied for the number one rated unit in the command.
Yeah, awesome. Just some attention to detail and actually actively managing things that are looked at a higher level. Readiness is looked at well above the wing.
Most importantly is we created a strategic plan, a 3-year training plan, which is something that I had done for years here in my role, and created a plan. And as we brought people in, so there just was never an effort in the way that we were doing it we were greening up UTCs by moving people who were trained into one UTC and then fixing those others. It just hadn't been done. And so it was just simple stuff, but we looked like geniuses.
Yeah. It's just a little bit of planning, a little bit of foresight rather than putting out fires. Right. I talked about that, the strategic alignment. I'm all about it because it gets us, instead of vectored 360 and putting out fires 360 degrees around, maybe we're vectored it in a 90-degree fan, and we're going to make more progress there. So that's, like you said, it's not genius, but it just requires some foresight. and some planning, like you said. So talk to me about what you did with the S team. You not only did you get it healthy and well, UTC readiness wise, but you also kind of took it to a new level in regards to how you were able to help COCOMs and specifically CENTCOM.
Yeah, that's something that I'm extremely proud about. And it's something that you're never going to read about, but those of us that were a part of it, it's a pretty unique experience and I'm happy to have done it. But because there was an underutilization of the S teams, COCOMs didn't realize that S teams exist. And S teams, there's each S team has got 3 12-person UTCs. The highest is an 06. So you got 06, an E9, a bulk of 05s, one E8 engineer assistant, and then some majors.
Yeah.
So a professional engineer team that's supposed to be plug and play at the MAGCOM level, at a COCOM level, and providing like specific professional engineer capabilities.
Right.
And people just didn't know what that meant and that we even existed. So what myself, Colonel Blanchett, and a couple others did, we set forth a plan to develop this relationship with AFCENT A7 and try to find some work for our team to do, to let everybody know, hey, here we are. We're here. There's 3 S teams in the reserve. I think there's 5 in the guard. And so we're just one of 3 units that possess the same capability. But we just happened to be tied with AFCENT A7. So we went there and said, hey, this is what we could do for you. And then what kind of work do you need? And they identified a need that they needed some engineer support to develop some war plans on. And we're talking war plans like full up O plans off the shelf. If the flag goes up, this is what we're executing. And so we put our best and brightest on this. And we did some projects and creating and writing annexes to these theater campaign plans. I mean, yeah. Just some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
If you're into that kind of thing, which, like I said, I'm a readiness nerd, but
our country needs to be into that type of thing based on what's going on in this world.
And so that's what we did. And we were able to create and buy positions through the FGC to get on tip fids for deployment so they could start picking S team UTCs so we could show that we've got these capabilities and we're able to execute it. And so it was just a lot of work in a short period of time that we were able to really highlight what
you said. You started out using the annual tour to augment or to help these functions, but eventually they started throwing money at you. It sounds like MPA and all that.
Yes.
Because you were so valuable to.
Well, not only that, but AFCENT isn't the prettiest person at the dance anymore.
Okay.
If you haven't noticed what's going on into the Far East, focus is really more towards the Indo-Pacific region. And so they weren't getting the love that they were in terms of resources and money and people. That's kind of being shifted away from them. So they had some money. They just didn't have the people to execute it. So it was just kind of the perfect storm.
Perfect storm for you.
Yeah.
Perfect. Absolutely. You know, I think that just shows great initiative. And I see that. And I saw that when you were in the ORI days. And I see that now as your chief of inspections running the IG shop. So how did the work you did in designing and helping with war plans help frame what we did in our exercise this weekend?
So the reality is that the future of conflict is not going to be, we're facing a different adversary. Let's just say that. So the models that were used in the last 30 years in the Middle East maybe don't translate as well. So we have to be a little bit more agile and be prepared to pick up and move to other places at relatively a moment's notice. And so what we did, parlaying the experience with AFCENT A7, the way we built this exercise for this particular weekend was simply that, hey, you've got a short notice, you have capabilities, you have a few things maybe in place, but you're going to pick up this group of people and you're going to go over there and establish this base at wherever that is. And that, I know that's going on in the Pacific as well.
Absolutely.
So based on conversations we've had, briefings that we've been a part of, that's ongoing as we speak, that we're prepping the battlefield and hopefully we don't ever get there, but we've got to be ready to, some of these installations that were built in the Second World War, taking a look at, you know, can we use these things and what would it take to revitalize these old airfields and what kind of pavements are, what's the shape of the pavement? So we send people out there just to do site surveys and determine what's available, what we can use. And then we build plans around it. And so that's the future of warfare. Mm-hmm. And that's the future in my mind when you speak to your task and purpose and talk about generating readiness, projecting power, and developing capabilities. We have to be kind of innovative in the way that we exercise and evaluate our capabilities because the old way of doing things doesn't work. Well, it's not going to work for the future. And so that's kind of what pulling some of these experiences that we used in my time in the S team here. So far, so good. I think it's working out pretty well.
Yeah.
In the short little sample size we have from this weekend.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's like I said, my new word is hyper. It's not because I'm drinking too much coffee. It's hyper relevant what we did this weekend. We went to a short notice base setup and we didn't keep it open very long because it's not going to survive very long because our enemy is going to know that we're turning sorties out of there and it's not going to survive very long. And there's a number that Colonel Orrick, he went to the RTRB, the Realistic Training and Readiness Board, and they came up with a, hey, in Indo-PACOM, the number is X. I can't say it, but we are pretty much on target for what that number is. So we're not going to be setting up these enduring bases. We're going to disperse to survive and aggregate to kill. No longer are we going to be able to operate out of the bases we operated during the Korean War, because we're still doing that.
Right.
You know, Osan Air Force Base was used during the Korean War, and they got the grid to what to target there. It's not a surprise. Those are things that we just kind of didn't see. I mean, now with precision capability weapons and stuff like that, these bases are going to be gone right away. So what's funny is if you look at almost every cluster of islands in the Pacific, which there are many, there is an old air base somewhere buried in the jungle. Somewhere on almost every island. So real opportunity out there. And you kind of set up a scenario where we went down and mowed the lawn or mowed the area and set up a base. And we would have been able to turn aircraft out of there today, tomorrow, and, you know, maybe the next couple of days based on the threat. So that's right on what we're going to have to do in either AO, quite honestly, as our enemy has longer legs and can strike us, as we saw what happened with Iran just last month. So awesome stuff. One thing you said that I think wraps up why you're here today, and that's what you did with CENTCOM. You fostered relationships. And I think you've done that since you were probably working for your dad, is that you fostered relationships everywhere you go. And it's based on who you are and how you do things at a high level. So one of the reasons I brought you back is because back when I was a major and you didn't like me very much because I was trying to leverage what the wing commander told us to do, is we fostered relationships. And it's based on friendship, but quite honestly, professional execution. So, Hootie man, I am so glad you're back in the wing. You're going to make us more lethal in the future. You're going to make us more ready. And we're doing it with smiles on our faces because we know each other. We respect each other. And we're going to have a good couple of years here. So thanks for sharing. Wait. We have one more thing.
Hey, I just, you know, I wanted to say thanks for the opportunity. You know, any chance I get to preach the goodness of IG, I will. And so I appreciate this platform, first of all. But secondly, I'm not here to toot my own horn or pat myself on the back, but I want you to know that this and the people out there listening, that we've been in situations where we were trained and prepared and sometimes not prepared to be in the situations that we found ourselves in. So all of this experience and this readiness and being ready to face unseen dangers in some of these scary situations is really the basis and the foundation for why I feel like it's our responsibility. My responsibility as the director of inspections to get our wing ready and sharpen that tip of the spear that we talked about with readiness. This 442nd fighter wing is the tip of the spear.
It is.
And we have to sharpen our skills. And so I really appreciate it. I'm so happy to be back here.
Yeah.
Doing this job, and it's not a pretty job, but it's super important.
Do you know what word we didn't use in this whole discussion?
What's
about
that?
Readiness and inspections? We didn't use IG because we're more about the readiness side with this program, and that's so important. And it's our job to make sure our youngest airman is ready when we send them downrange to combat. And that's something you said to me in one meeting. I went, wow, you're right. That's our job. And it's every airman's job in this wing to make sure that their friend, their subordinate, their superior is ready as well. So big team here. Again, thanks for joining it.
Thank you.
So you got it.